happened to your mother's love? What happened to your daddy's pride? I know you always had enough. I know they were right by your side. What happened to that ball of fire? But your own desire will lighten up this heavy load. Hold on, hold on, hold on. I know you didn't plan for this.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Book of Jude. I'm Ray Duncan, here interviewing my mom, Jude Johnstone. So, Mom, I'm thinking, since we're on the topic of how you got your songs to certain artists, how you went about doing that, why don't we go ahead and talk about how you got your song Hold On to Emmylou Harris?
Well, Emmylou, let's see. I met Emmylou way back in 1994 at Trisha Yearwood's wedding to Robert Reynolds, which was at the Ryman Auditorium. And I remember Garth Fundis was standing there talking to her, and he saw me and waved me over and introduced me to Emmylou. And he said something like, Jude wrote a couple of songs for Trisha, you know, Hearts in Armor and Nightingale. And she said, oh, my daughter has been learning to play the guitar, and she's been working on your song, Hearts in Armor.
Wow.
And I love hearing her play it from the other room. And that was my meeting Emmylou for the first time. And I didn't have any contact with her in particular after that. But a little later, a few years later, my friend Valerie Carter introduced me to Buddy and Julie Miller. And she was doing a show in Nashville with them, opening for them. And I was playing with her in her band. And so we got to hang out a little bit, rehearse, and I really loved that couple. I had really liked their music before that. And when I went to do my second record on a good day, I had Julie sing a harmony on a song called Old and Gray with me.
Don't let me grow old and gray and watch all my best friends go one by one. It seems like a high price to pay for a few extra circles around the sun. Not all of us know. Don't let me grow. Don't let me grow and gray.
I didn't realize that was her.
Yes, okay. Yes, that's Julie.
That's really cool.
Singing. And Buddy, of course, recorded that in their house for me and sent me that track. And so I was in touch with him. And so when I finished the record, naturally, they were interested in hearing it since Julie was on it. So I sent him a copy, and Buddy really liked the record. And we were on the phone together, and he said, you know, I couldn't put it down. I had to listen the whole way through because it just went together like a, you know, like a tapestry. And I said, that's exactly what it is. You know, it's the story of my family back in Maine.
Right.
And the songs do kind of go together.
It's the closest to like a concept album you've really ever done.
Extremely so.
Yeah. I'd never really thought of it that way. I was so young when it came out.
Yeah, that's true. It was very much a fabric, you know.
Cool.
And at any rate, he liked it so much that he gave it to Emmylou Harris to listen to. And that's how she heard the song Hold On.
And that's how many years after that wedding where you first met her?
That's quite a few.
Yeah.
I don't recall when she put Hold On out, but it's only about three records ago.
Got it.
You know what I mean? So it's in the 2000 somethings. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a bit later. But at any rate, she had really liked the song Hold On and the song Hereafter. And what was interesting about that and her strange radar mm-hmm. is those two songs I wrote about my nephew, Nicholas, and his struggle and then his death in the hereafter.
Yeah.
She had no idea that those songs were written about the same person. Mm-hmm. And those were the two she gravitated toward. And she ended up doing Hold On.
Mother's love happened to your daddy's pride. Way down deep inside your blood, to help you through this lonely ride.
I still long for her to do her version of the hereafter.
Oh, that would just slay.
It would slay. Just, yeah.
Oh my God.
I haven't given up yet.
All your comrades are here as the church bells they ring, and the snow is still melting, though it's nearly spring. And the sky up above us is filled with red wings as they welcome you in the hereafter. Though our hearts are too heavy to find comfort yet, and there are no words written to help us forget, we hold on to the memories and wait for the rest as you make your way in the hereafter. Though we can't understand why you've taken the sun and left all your loved ones who've gathered, now the wind's at your back, and whatever you lack, you will find it out in the hereafter.
But she did a great version of Hold On, and what was the name of that record? Do you remember? It was, I want to say it's like All I Intended to Be. Is that it?
I think that's dead on. I think you're right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you went on to have a really nice friendship with her over the years.
Absolutely. I've even made her shrimp and grits and taken it to her house.
Well, and you opened for her a couple times.
Yeah, I opened for her in Avila Beach in California.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember being a little kid backstage at those shows.
Well, of course, and then when I did my Quiet Girl album, I asked her to sing the harmony on that song,
the
title
harmony.
Cut.
Yeah.
Quiet Girl. And she did.
Yeah.
And so I still really enjoy that. I still think that song's a hit.
The alto.
Oh, and then you, of course, are mm-hmm. singing the other
That's
part.
That's right.
Excuse me for forgetting. I'm a quiet girl now, but I'm wide awake. Took a shot at love, but it didn't take. I'm a quiet girl now, but I'm wide awake. Quiet girls know better how to.
That's so wonderful to listen back to that.
It is.
Because what an amazing voice.
I know, and your voices sounded great together. There's no doubt about that.
I must have been really young, like 14 maybe.
I guess so.
Because I was still that young.
But you had that alto voice, like I do. You have that alto, and you can't tell, you couldn't tell then that you were anything like that age.
Yeah.
You certainly sounded 18 at least, and that, you know, that was fine for background vocal.
Totally. Anyway,
you know, I really wanted her to record that song. I mean, I thought it was such a great tune for her. I thought she would have killed it. And so for some reason I heard her voice on it, obviously, and I thought, well, you know, I'll just ask her to sing on it. And she did with you. And it sounds great. I wouldn't trade it. But it killed any possibility of her doing the song herself.
Because exactly.
You're not going to do a song that you sung the background vocal to on somebody else's record, even if that's an unknown somebody.
No, it's still because it's less unknown already just by her singing on it.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, from her standpoint, it would be like, why would I do that?
Why would I do that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so later I thought, that was kind of a dumb move, Jude. But, you know, it sounds great. And she may have never done the song anyway. And, you know, she did a different song of mine.
Right.
But, you know, you have to think about all of those kind of choices right at the time that you're doing it.
And being strategic, like you're saying, like retrospectively.
Yes.
As far as when you have somebody like Emmy Lou Harris who's willing to either sing a background for you or who is a fan of your work and like would sing on one of your songs or do one of your songs, you have to take that opportunity and be really strategic with it. Not in like a cold way, not in like a calculating way, but just in like a, how am I utilizing this?
Right. Yeah.
Properly, you know, because like you said, like she's smart. She's not going to cut the song if you just cut the song.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah. Just one of those little things that when you look back, you can see every little step you took and you kind of go,
where you put your foot down wrong.
Yeah, might have put my foot down wrong here. And my career is littered with those moments.
I mean, I'm just trying to put my foot down, like, anywhere.
Yeah, that, I hear that.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I think this town is full of people just trying to put their feet down somewhere on something.
Exactly. Jennifer Warnes once said to me, when I was a kid playing at my place in Santa Monica, and I was complaining, you know, about the record companies not signing me and what was their problem, you know. And she said, you got to watch out for desperation. Desperation is not attractive.
Right. And I remember you telling me that.
And I really thought long and hard about that advice. I never forgot it. You know, she said, you know, you can't show them that face.
Yeah.
And it's not like it's a cat and mouse game, but it sort of is, you know? And, you know, that mystique that people have often, you know, when they, right before they get signed, you know, there's a certain mystique that they carry, not getting too close to the record executives, you know?
Yeah.
Just keeping it out there like a carrot. And I got way too friendly, you know, with several A&R guys at the time, you know, to the point of like helping them decide which ceiling tiles to put in their office.
Right, which some people would think is the right way to play it.
Well,
but you're here to
you
say,
know, I mean, I like would go to
it.
Home Depot with Tom Wally. You know what I mean?
Well, right.
And I crossed a line and I was so young that I thought, yeah, these guys should be my buddies, right?
Right.
Mistake. Because then all of a sudden they can't separate you as a friend, you know, from a prospective client.
Right. Because they're still looking at it. They still have to be able to take you out of that and just look at what's in it for us to take a chance on this artist.
And it destroyed my chances because we just were chums. And one of them even said to me, you're just too close to me now. I don't think I could sign you without being biased. And I shot myself in the foot.
Yeah.
And so if anybody ever asks me now about how to approach that relationship, I would say keep the mystique going.
I wonder how that applies to the way things are now.
I'm not sure because
that's genuinely a question because I don't know the answer.
Well, because we, as I said, in LA, it seems that we were all so close with the guys that had that power. They all came out to the shows. They, you know, you're bumping into these people all the time. So it's a fine line how to know when to draw the line. It took more practice than I realized. And I was just too young. And like Jennifer said, you know, I had that look on my face.
Yeah.
Sign me. And I don't think it works. I think they like it to be, for one thing, their idea. You know, you can't spoon feed them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was a mistake, one mistake that I made back then.
Back to, you know, the being desperate sort of thing.
Yes, exactly.
It's a tricky line to walk because, like, you do have to want it bad to be here and to be doing what we're doing. You have to want it bad.
Yeah, you do.
But then you have to kind of act like you don't.
I know it sounds like a relationship, you know, like a playing hard to get thing.
Right.
But, you know, it really is. It's reminiscent of that.
What I think it is, though. It is almost in like a Zen sort of detachment way. It's about...
Yeah, you're right.
You have to actually kind of believe that detachment.
Yeah.
Because that's been hard for me is like, I know what I want, but you have to navigate with such a detachment towards it.
Yeah, you have to make them see that they need you rather
it's
than
not
the
even
reverse.
It's not even about making them see anymore. To me, it's about making myself see. You know, it's like, I would be an asset. I believe that.
That's what I mean.
I believe that.
Yeah.
And so that's something that, I mean, with what little experience I do have, I feel like that takes people a long way. That's something that I notice.
Yeah.
In
artists. I think you're right. I couldn't possibly have been detached at that time.
Well, right. I
was not in a Zen space at that time.
Well, and neither am I. Like, this is something that takes a lot of the effort to, like, cultivate and maintain.
Yeah, it does.
To like, the gnawing ambition is driving the bus, but it's not veering off the road. It's
exactly.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good way to put it. You know, another thing Leonard used to say was, you can't read the good reviews unless you're willing to read the bad.
Oof.
He said, I don't read any of them because none of them are true.
Oh my God.
He said, the exalted view of your work isn't quite true. Nor is the entirely negative view. The truth of your work is somewhere in between.
He said that to you in like a normal conversation?
He said that to me in a normal conversation.
How did you remember all of that?
Well, because it's the
I mean,
kind
it's
of
so
thing.
Memorable,
that, yeah, it was memorable. Because I think it was because I told him that I had got, that somebody had seen a live show of mine and said something very negative about it.
Sure.
You know, that I was, you know, I wasn't happening. There was nothing to what I was doing or something like that. And that just before that, somebody had said, wow, she's such a great songwriter or whatever. And that was his response. His response was basically, neither is true. The only truth is that thing that you are paying attention to and chiseling away at. You're doing what you're meant to do. And whether somebody gets it or they don't get it, it's still there. It's still the same. The only truth is in what you're doing without them.
That's incredible.
And you know, he had that song Jennifer covered of his on her famous Blue Raincoat record that's all about the critic. The singer must die. It's called The Singer Must Die. And it was really in response to critics and the sort of power they give themselves when
really
the
odd.
Only power is yours.
It's really interesting. Like, I kind of have a couple different points of view on it because on one hand, I think that everyone who wants to make art should.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an incredibly human thing to partake in
mm-hmm.
and that it can belong to everyone. And I don't wish to be gatekeeping or elitist about that because it's something that it's a way that humans have always expressed our joy and our exuberance and
our
being alive. On the other hand, in the world of doing this as commodity,
right.
doing this for a living, working your whole life to better your craft, and yet even going to school or spending money in the studio, whatever it is that you choose to, you know, divert towards it, it's your effort and it's, you know, your
it's
blood,
valuable.
You know?
It's valuable, you know, on its own.
So I guess that's my point is like, at what point does the critic's job become valuable only in the sense to point towards the person who's made it to the top of the heap.
Well, to point others to it,
yeah,
to discovering it. You can understand why a great review is going to help you in
it's
some
really
ways.
Interesting.
But to him, it was like, but if I believe that review,
yeah,
I have to believe that other nonsense.
Exactly.
And therefore, I don't open that newspaper.
Right. I mean, I would say he's right.
You know, I just thought it went along with like his entire Zen attitude.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't surprise me that not long after I was around him, I think it was around 94, he was fairly disillusioned because he joked about the record company never calling him back, you know, never returning his calls and things. And because he was really not that popular yet, and they would just send him on these grueling tours, and they were not actually that successful. And so he became quite put off with the whole thing. And he also liked to drink and women and everything that you might have heard. And he became a little bit worried about himself, I think, and he decided to move out of LA about 40 miles east to Mount Baldy, where there was a monastery. And so he moved to this monastery and he stayed there for 5 years. But as much as he sort of liked the ritual of it or the isolation of it, after a while he realized it wasn't really helping him, partly because his guru sort of became his late night drinking buddy at the monastery.
Mm.
And
it's an interesting dynamic.
But anyway, he finally decided that he wasn't really getting that much out of it. It wasn't curing his depression that
yeah.
he suffered from. And so he came back to civilization. And when he did, he discovered, not long after, he discovered his manager at the time had embezzled most of his money while he was gone. And he had to go out on tour and cross his fingers, you know, that he could get out of this hole he was in.
Yeah.
And so he did do that. And sort of while he was gone, I'm not really sure why, but everyone that was considered cool at the time, you know, Dylan and you know, Bono and, you know, the people that were popular at the time were all just seemed to be talking about him.
Hmm.
They seemed to have noticed what a talent he was. And so there was a sort of a buzz happening. So this time when he went out on tour, he had been much more popular in Europe anyway all along. But this time he booked a long tour and it was not only a success, it was the beginning of a huge renaissance in his career.
Yeah, which happened like later in his
yeah.
career. I mean, because I don't know when that coincides with...
It was
you know, like Jeff
like
Buckley doing 2000s. Hallelujah. You know,
yeah,
I know.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Like all of that.
Everybody became interested in him.
Yeah.
And he even never really knew why. I remember him saying that reading an interview or something with him, because suddenly everyone wanted to interview him. And when he
yeah.
got back from this long tour that was such a success, he made several more records and up until the time he died, he was tremendously successful at that later stage of his life. And so it was interesting. But I remember him saying, you know, suddenly the record company was calling him.
Yeah.
And he was horribly amused by that.
Yeah. A little bit of an I told you so.
A little bit.
Moment.
Yeah. Exactly.
A well-deserved one.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But that was the story. That was the bulk of the story, was that.
Yeah.
And, you know, he did, of course, get out of debt and then some.
Sometimes the good guys win.
That's
after
right.
some trials and tribulations.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. I mean, it'd be so hard in that position to... It would mess with your head so much, and I don't see how he couldn't have just crazy trust issues after that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you
just
mean.
Just being famous anyway, it's like everyone's watching you, And who do you trust? Who's taking advantage?
Well,
who's
I think
really on
what
your side?
You come to realize what he came to realize because of the reversal, you know, of the they didn't have any interest in him. They would just push him off to some grueling tour that wasn't really successful, and he was just exhausted. basically. Yeah. And I think when he came back and everything turned kind of golden for him, he just had the knowledge of how fickle the business is, and that it is certainly all business.
Really interesting to get that sort of cosmic reward.
I know, really. I'm waiting for that, too.
Right.
I'm still waiting for that.
The cosmic reward, yes. Well, so I know we've talked a bit about Trisha Yearwood during this podcast. She's done several of your songs, but I'm curious, how did you get the first song to her? What was the first song?
First song was The Woman Before Me, which, of course, is the only number one song I've ever written. But it's an interesting story, because when I wrote that song, it was clearly a country song. And I'd never written a country song in my life.
Right.
I didn't listen to country music. But I played it for Charles, my husband, and he said, "It is a country song. Wow. Who are you going to send it to?" And so I had no idea. I didn't know anybody in Nashville. And so I asked my manager about it. And he said, "I know this guy that road manages Don Williams." And I said, "Well, that'll do. But it's a girl song. But maybe we could get it to his producer, you know?"
Right.
Anyway, long story short, we did that. And the cassette tape made its way to Garth Fundis's office in the Sound Emporium studio.
So this is also how you got connected to Garth then?
Yes, it is.
This is the beginning of that relationship. Okay.
It is. And the guy that ran his studio, Scott Pascoe, sort of had a pile of cassette tapes, not unlike Clarence Clemens's basket of cassette tapes, mm-hmm, in Seawright, New Jersey. And one of the things that Scott did, probably in his, you know, spare time, was he would listen occasionally to one of these cassettes. And he came across mine. And it was only just the one song. And because he picked it up and listened to it and liked it, he played it for Garth Fundis. Now, at the time, Trisha Yearwood was unknown.
Yeah.
She and her pal, Garth Brooks, had both been singing demos for everybody else in town.
Right.
So songwriters hired them to sing their songs to pitch for cuts with major artists. And so what happened with Trisha is that people started noticing her voice.
Oh, yeah.
On these demos. And some of the record guys were like, "Who is this girl singing these demos for whoever?" Yeah. And they started becoming interested in her as an artist herself. And at the time, Garth Fundis heard the song, The Woman Before Me. He called and said, "We would like to play this song at Douglas Corner, where Trish is doing a showcase."
Yeah.
For the record companies. There's several.
At Douglas Corner, yes, in Nashville on 8th Ave.
At Douglas.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so
they're not even open anymore.
Maybe not.
Or at least not last time I checked. I know there was something with pandemic and whatnot. I mean, gosh, what a great place.
But yeah, so he said, "We'd like to play the song for the record companies, if you wouldn't mind." And I said, "Please play the song. I mean, I don't know anyone but you, Mr. Fundis."
Right.
"Do whatever you want
to
do.
You don't really got anything to lose."
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so a few days later, he called back and he said, "She's signing with MCA Records, and they'd like to secure the song."
Wow. And I had no idea the alignment of, like, her career ascending in that way.
And we'd like to do it on her debut album.
The woman before me must have been hard on you, 'cause that hurt in your eyes I never put you through. Sometimes I think you must be talking to the woman before me and you. Sometimes in an argument."
So that was like one of her first number one songs?
Well, it was the fourth.
Okay.
Her debut album went way up on the charts. It debuted higher than any female artist with a debut album had ever done. And so immediate attention. She got immediate attention. The opening song was the John Imes song, She's in Love with the Boy. And it was a huge hit.
I didn't know She's in Love with the Boy. That's her.
Yeah, yeah. That's John Imes' song.
And oh my God.
She had a huge hit with that. And then followed by another hit and another hit. And then Scott Bruschetta, promotion over at MCA.
Right.
And it was his idea to release a fourth single. This is back when we released singles, and things were kind of different than that.
Well, singles that weren't just standalone singles like
yeah,
we do
it was
now,
off the album.
It's singles to promote that body of work.
Exactly.
Which is not as often now.
But that's the way it was done until recently. And so you had to convince the record company to promote that another single. It takes some money and some time for people to get excited about it. And four singles deep is pretty deep. And usually only the sort of more well-known artists would go that deep. But he convinced them to release The Woman Before Me. And it went to number one. It was the fourth number one song from that record.
I didn't know that Scott Bruschetta was the one who convinced them to do that.
Yeah, and of course you know he's the one that found...
He's Big Machine Records, right?
He found Taylor Swift.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody knows him.
He introduced me to her when she was about 17.
Yeah.
At a barbecue in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah.
But he went on to start his own company, as you said, later. But at the time, he was one of the guys in MCA. And in fact, when he started his own company, Big Machine, when Trisha's deal was up with MCA, she went with Big Machine at the time. I don't know who she's with now.
But I see. Okay.
She followed him there. Anyway, that was our experience with The Woman Before Me. And obviously that was a thrill. The only country song I'd ever written, and makes you wonder why I didn't write a few more.
You know, you can't, you can't rush art. You can't force art.
That was the country song that you wrote. That was my country song.
And it's better than a lot of people's best, I gotta say.
Well, she ended up doing...
But I'm biased.
She ended up doing several other songs of mine that were kind of like, you know, Hearts in Armor, Title Cut, and, you know, the end of the album. And she had Don Henley sing the harmony on that, which, of course, introduced me to Don Henley.
And all that came
and
about.
And all that implies, yes. And all the work I did with Henley after that was all because he happened to sing on that song for Trisha. And more often than not, in my career anyway, a thing led to a thing led to a thing. That's the way it worked. Mm-hmm. Somebody introduced me to somebody, and then they played it for somebody else, and then... like a domino effect.
The many branches of a tree is kind of how I'm thinking of it. Because you have all these people who have affiliations with each other in these different capacities, and then somebody sings a background on this, and then somebody plays this for this person. And that's really the through line that we're seeing, and a lot of it is just up to chance.
I was thinking I got most of my cuts sort of by myself. And as I looked back while we've been doing this podcast, I realized that nearly none of them, other than Bonnie Raitt, Clarence, and Don Henley, were the only ones I really sort of just got by myself. And even Henley required help. I actually asked Bonnie Raitt to send him this song of mine, Good Guy. And she did, because I couldn't get a hold of him. I had no way to reach him other than asking a friend that was friends with him. So in effect, she really got that cut for me as well. There was always somebody passing something to someone else on my behalf. And looking back, I kind of feel a lot of gratitude.
No kidding.
But after The Woman Before Me, then when they went to do the second album, they were basically done. And I've told you that there have been times that I wasn't very prolific, and I would have long periods where I wasn't writing, and I wasn't inspired to write. And when they were getting ready to do the second album, I was in one of those spaces. Mm-hmm. There was only one song I was working on, and I felt like it was so right for her. But I couldn't get the first line of it. And so I kept chiseling away at it. And then I would be in touch with them. How are you doing on the record? How's it going? And they, we're done. We're mixing. It's done. And I went, dang. Well, I've just finished the song. I guess I'll send it to them anyway. And of course, I had that good fortune thing that occasionally happens where they take something off the album and put my song on. And they made it the title cut, Hearts in Armor, for the sophomore album. It was, it's still my favorite record she's ever done. I love that album. I've had songs on other records of hers, but that was my favorite album. I just loved, there was a certain diversity, you know, that was unmistakable. The song choices were just excellent on that record. And it didn't hurt that Don Henley sang on two of the songs.
Certainly not.
Anyway, after that, she did a third album. My song, The Nightingale, was on that. Another fun thing that happened once we moved to Cambria was, you know, with all that Tricia had, by that time she had done three songs. She had done The Woman Before Me, Hearts in Armor, and The Nightingale. And The Nightingale, the timing, it was just that great timing that happens, which was, for one, it was not a sad song. It was a happy song, you know, sort of about how good I felt after we moved and settling into our new house. And it was just this, you know, a celebration in effect. Mm. And even though the music, you know, my music always, you know, sort of sounds sad,
like,
anyway.
It's a happy song that sounds incredible.
That sounds sad. Especially with all those strings and everything. But anyway, Tricia at the time was getting married to Robert Reynolds, which I mentioned earlier, where I met Emmy Lou at their wedding at the Ryman. It was just that perfect timing that she was in that headspace, that very romantic, things are working out after all feeling. And so it was a perfect song for her at the time. But since we talked quite frequently at the time, she was asked. The Hearts in Armor cover was really kind of glamorous. And, you know, Don Henley was on the record and a couple of other notable people also. And for some reason at the time, Revlon approached her to have her own perfume.
Yeah.
And it was called Wild Heart. And they wanted her to write a song for it. And so she asked me, what can you come up with for this? It needs to be kind of smoky, kind of Bonnie Raitt-ish, kind of like that. So I went to your father and said, let's do this together. Mm. You know, come up with a verse groove that's kind of, you know, kind of sexy for this. And we'll come up with the words that make sense. We have to use this Wild Heart as the chorus or tag or whatever.
Oh, my God.
And we cooked up something that was really pretty cool. And next thing I knew, you know, they had made a fabulous demo of it. It's several versions, like, you know, this many seconds, that many, according to what the commercial wanted to use, and got all the great Nashville players to play on it. And it was so cool that she almost thought about just doing it.
Did it make it into the commercial?
Oh boy, did it ever.
Yeah. Where can I see?
I have the audio. It was super cool.
Oh my God. So you and Dad co-wrote that?
We did.
That's so funny.
And they paid us handsomely for it.
Love is precious and love is sweet. But don't forget what's under.
Fragrance from Revlon.
Anyway, we had a blast. And Tricia, she drove up to Cambria. She flew to Los Angeles because she was going to come work it out with us, you know? And so she flew to LA and she rented a Mustang. She loved Ford Mustangs. You know, she rented like a 60s Mustang. And she said, I'm driving up. I've got my Mustang.
Oh my
I'm
God.
On my way. And so
I think I remember
she came
that.
To our house, the Blue House.
No, okay, I wasn't alive.
Yeah, she came after to the house.
Time.
Yeah, she came later when we moved to the big house. But she came when we lived in the Blue House to write this song with
in
us.
Her Mustang.
And when she got there, Charles and I had it ready, and we played it down for her. And she listened, and she went, "Well, that's great. I think that's done. Let's go shopping." And then she and I went walking around the neighborhood, you know, different clothing stores, and picked up a couple of things. And I remember at the time we went into this one store and she gave him her credit card. And it was just before she was, well, I mean, she was very famous, but in the little town of Cambria, there would be people not expecting to see her.
Yeah.
And so, and she's got her shades on or whatever. And I remember her looking at me like, geez, nobody recognizes me. She seemed like she was just a little bit disappointed.
I feel like that wouldn't happen now.
It would definitely not happen
especially
now.
Especially with more social media and stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, it would never happen now. But it was humorous.
That's
it,
funny.
At the time. But one funny thing was my neighbors, Fred and Dorothy, next door, they were like in their 90s. And they were just the cutest little couple. And I wouldn't know what music they listened to or, you know. He was a cowboy, though. You know, a real one that had worked at Hearst Ranch in the old days.
Right.
Anyway, once Tricia came and hung out, we finished the song. Everything was okey-doke. And she sung it with us, you know, got used to it. She was on her way. She drove off in this Mustang. And Dorothy came to my door. And she said, "Was that who I think it was?" And I said, it was Tricia Yearwood, yes. And she said, "I knew it was. I
oh
just knew
God.
It." And it was the cutest thing.
Aww.
So from then on, they were like wondering, what the heck was I doing next door?
Of course.
Who is this girl next door? With her little toddler running around the backyard and Tricia Yearwood in the driveway.
In her Mustang.
Yeah, it was funny.
That's cute.
But it went well. And, you know, it was a lot of fun and it was a pretty good paycheck, too.
Yeah.
Your dad did a good job on that.
Wow.
And then I think there were a couple records that went by that I wasn't on. And then she did a song of mine called When We Were Still in Love.
Just always been and in your corner.
She was going to do another song of mine, Bitter Truth. That one fell out. And then She did Good Guy on Henley's project, but that wasn't a record that was released to the public. It was
discussed the logistics of that.
Yeah, but I still consider that a cut because paid a whole lot of money for it. And that's the last time she's done one of my songs. Yeah.
Well, that's just really cool. And I mean, she's still doing a lot of cool stuff. She's got her like cooking and stuff that she does.
And now she's married to her demo singer friend.
I know. And how sweet is that? And yeah, I think I follow her on the social media, and her personality on there is really fun.
Yeah, she's a natural entertainer, you know, far beyond just being a great singer. She's got her cooking show, and it's like, she's just a natural, you know. Yeah. She can do anything. She's a media mogul, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, she's certainly done a lot for you.
Yeah, and there have been many, many times that, as I said, that different people have passed a song on to somebody like Mary Black, you know, after I started playing in Ireland so much, and I came in contact with Nicky Scott, Van Morrison's longtime bass player. You yourself have played with him. He has played with you.
How could I forget?
In Ireland, and he's a marvelous player.
At Maggie's Farm, that wonderful venue.
A friend of mine said, did you know you have a song on Mary Black's new collection? And I said, what? Because I've always wanted Mary Black to do a song of mine and had no idea how to get one to her. And once again, Nicky Scott, he played her some of my songs.
And you knew Nicky Scott because you met him at the same time as like Dave Keery and Lindley and all those guys who played with Van.
Yeah, in
Morrison.
Fact, Dave Keery could not make one gig that we were doing at this beautiful kind of hall. And I needed somebody in his place. And although Nicky's a bass player, he plays upright, you know, which is what I use generally for bass.
Yeah.
And it can be bowed and do all kinds of cool stuff. And so Dave said, Nicky can do that show with you. And I had a guitarist, a wonderful guitarist, young man from Ulster University, that sat in with us that night.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Doherty. And that's where I met Nicky, and we just got on so well that at some point he was going out on the road with Mary. She was putting out kind of a big greatest hit sort of collection, remaster, you know, that kind of thing. And she decided to put a couple of new songs attached to the thing. And one of them was my song Wounded Heart, which Bonnie Raitt had already cut. And Mary did a version with full string section, quite stunning.
Wow.
And then she came to City Winery in Nashville to play the show with Nicky, playing with her. And I knew she was going to play my song. And so that was a thrill. I got to meet her that night and watch her play my song. And before she played it, she started introducing it. And I realized it was my song she was talking about. And she said, Nick brought me some songs by this woman, and I had to record this one, and I'm so nervous because I know she's in the audience tonight.
How sweet is that?
I know. And I thought, oh, brother.
If you listen, you can hear the angel's wings up above our heads so near. They are hovering, waiting to reach out for love when it falls apart, when it cannot rise above. Oh,
well, it certainly makes it worth doing what you do, you know? I mean,
that's for sure.
And Nicky Scott is such an easy guy to get along with, and we got to play with him in Ireland, and he's played on a demo of mine that has yet to be released.
That's right. I can't hardly wait until it is, because also on that demo is legendary Vinnie Colaiuta.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So that's a rhythm section, but we'll leave y'all wondering about that. And I think that's probably all we need to cover for today. So just really, having friends in the business doesn't hurt. Being likable, being whatever you were that got all these people playing your music, I guess just being exceptional, really. Try to be exceptional, I guess.
That's a good idea.
I don't know how helpful that is. But no, I mean, being friendly and having good friends in the industry, it all pays off, and it might pay off 8 years later. You never know. You have to have faith, and you have to keep writing. Just have faith and keep writing, y'all. We'll see you next time. And every hour that goes by, the harder I become. Because I let that well run dry. Because I let you unanswered. One more day, my heart's in armor. Though I did not see it then, I would finish what you started if I had that chance again.